Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, another possible delay for the Brooklyn Village project, as city staff recommends Charlotte City Council deny the developer funding because it's too much money at this time. Republican Councilman Tariq Bakari ends his tenure on city council on Sunday to take a job with the Trump administration. A court ruling puts the focus on 1,675 ballots in the state Supreme Court race between Allison Riggs and Jefferson Griffin. What happens next could change the outcome of that race. The state Senate proposes more money for Hurricane Helene recovery, even as Republicans in that chamber double down on tax cuts, more wildfires in the mountains, and don't split before we tell you about the Savannah Bananas. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zach Turner. Nick Oxner joins us. He's chief investigative reporter at WBTV. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back.
Morning.
Thank you. So we're going to begin in 2016. That's when Charlotte City Council first approved the plans for the development of Brooklyn Village in the city's second ward. It was proposed to pay homage to the original Brooklyn neighborhood, which was raised during urban development in the 1960s. Years have gone by, and this week, city staff came to council with a recommendation. Alex, what did they recommend?
They are recommending that the city not give $13.5 million in funding to this project right now. Just to give a little bit of background here, Brooklyn Village recently revamped their plans, and they told the county that they were going to, instead of doing market rate apartments with 10% of those apartments being set aside as affordable, it was going to do all affordable apartments, 250 units. So they were hoping to get some gap financing from the county and also this money from the city, from the housing trust fund. And right now the city said that $13.5 million is just too much money. It's the largest request they've ever received from an affordable housing developer. And there are also just a lot of negative associations with this project because of the history here. There's a lot of skepticism. It's taken a really long time to get construction started. So I don't know how much they want to be involved right now.
Yeah, when they proposed this, they've had several scenarios that they were going to develop and build. The Peebles Corporation is who we're talking about. They were designated to be the developer for this project about 10 years ago. And they had proposed apartments, they had proposed office space, they proposed a hotel. But nearly 10 years have gone by. Not a single brick has been laid. Not a hole in the ground has been dug. And earlier this year, as you mentioned, they came back to council and they said, hey, we'll turn all of these apartments, all 250 of them, into affordable housing apartments. Now, this goes right to our wheelhouse in Charlotte, Ryan. This is something that the mayor has been pushing for her entire term in office, and yet they asked for this $13.5 million from the Housing Trust Fund. Why is that too important? I mean, we have $100 million in that fund, or more.
Right. Well, this would be a record high allocation from that fund, although they are now working with a record high allocation from their budget last year of $100 million. But I just think it's a lot of they just sort of don't trust this moving forward anymore. Malcolm Graham gave a whole spiel about the fact that he has three centenarians in his family and he's going to have to live past 100 if he thinks he's going to see it go through before he passes. So he sort of led the way in expressing this reluctance that the city council has to continue pouring money into a project that we've seen no progress on. Like you said, there's been all sorts of issues and no moving forward.
Just to put this into perspective, the Peebles Corporation asked for $13.5 million from the Housing Trust Fund, which we go to the polls and we say yes to these housing bonds every couple of years. And the last time we said yes to $100 million at Monday's meeting, The city staff recommended $35 million of those dollars be earmarked for rental housing production, $25 million for home ownership projects, $14 million for rental housing preservation, $9 million for supportive housing and shelter, as well as other multi-million dollar pots of money. So this $13.5 million denial, at least the recommendation of one by city staff, means that there is really something going on here, something wrong. And the fact that this project has been delayed for so long is an indication of that. Why don't they pull the plug on this company and move on, Alex?
I think that was why Peoples came back and said he was going to do all these affordable units, is because it was starting, like, the conversation with the commissioners were starting to head that way, where they were saying, like, let's look at what legal action we could possibly take, or let's look at our legal documents and see if there's a kind of a way out of this. And then I think they were trying to steer the conversation back. But even after hearing the plan for the affordable units, one of the commissioners, Elaine Powell, said that she still felt nauseous whenever this comes up on the agenda, because it just has such a bad history here. And like Ryan said, it's like the whole project is to kind of honor this community, and the descendants are getting older, and it's been a decade. So
yeah,
people are saying, I want to be alive to see this. They are serious.
It was five councils ago where they made the decision to go with this developer, Ryan.
Right, and I should just clarify that staff suggested deferring the project and not denying it, so that it will be part of the next round. A new round of RFP starts in May and goes, I think, to like November. So they're going to look at it again in November to see if there's any progress been made, I guess. But they just didn't feel comfortable right now without any updates. We got the tariffs coming in. They've been blaming inflation for the last few years, so there's not like things are about to get any cheaper.
So this was a recommendation by city staff to city council. What was city council's reaction? I know that you've already mentioned, Alex, some of the people who were a little skeptical of this, but have they taken a vote on this? Or have they just decided to table it? Are they taking the recommendation just to delay it? What are they doing?
Yeah, things could change. It's just a non-recommendation for now, and the process is going to reopen, and the city seems willing to meet with Peoples and the county. I think a lot of people do want to see this project go through, so there could be some negotiations that happen, but I don't think right now is the time. They think they need to work some more things out.
Well, Rebecca Hefner, who is Director of Housing and Neighborhood Services, says it is possible that the city could find a way to fund this project. Did she offer any suggestions as to how?
Not yet.
Okay.
Just the willingness to meet with Peoples and the county and to try to, they need gap financing from the county. They want state low income housing tax credits. So there are a lot of moving parts here that they have to get solidified.
Every developer who's been asked to put in affordable housing units has asked for money because it's economically not feasible to build, in some cases, on very valuable land, projects that don't pay market rate. And that would be the case here. And when they came in with this proposal to do 250 units, all of them being affordable housing units, the question was raised, Ryan, how can they afford to do it? Well, clearly they can't. They need money from the city, but the city does this. So why is this a problem? And does this indicate there's something financially wrong going on here with the company itself?
Right, yeah. And I think that Rebecca Hefner did sort of even refer to that in passing and say that there are financial issues that the staff has come across with this project, and we don't feel comfortable recommending continuing to pour money into it. I think they're just going to keep deferring until, like you said, no one's dug a hole on the site yet. Someone needs to go dig a hole. Someone needs to put a piece of wood up. Somebody needs to do something before they're going to even start to continue pouring money into this. But at the same time, there might be something deeper there. It sounded like, if you read between the lines of Hefner's presentation, they're just not confident that Peoples is going to step up and do that anytime soon.
Okay. A couple of weeks ago, Republican Charlotte City Councilman Tariq Bakari announced his intention to leave Charlotte City Council. His last day, in fact, will be this Sunday, as he prepares to become the number two official at the Federal Transit Administration. Under Donald Trump, he will be the FTA's deputy administrator, and at Monday's City Council meeting, Bakari said he would continue to do whatever he could to support Charlotte and the city and support the city on everything they're working on. Everything. He didn't do that when he was on council. Well, one thing that they've been working on has been this transit plan, which has been years, just like this project at Brooklyn Village, has been years in the making. Has he given any indication that he might help or be able to help or be inclined to help with that project at the federal level? Ryan.
I think that speech on Monday is a sort of resignation speech when they announced his official last day will be this coming Sunday was the first time that he's really addressed and said that. He didn't speak about the transit plan. Like you said, you quoted him. He said, I'm willing to help with whatever you guys are working on. That was sort of his way of saying, you know, I'm behind, you know, that's obviously the transit administration. And our biggest thing that the city council is working on is the transit plan. So it's something that he will have sway over to a certain extent. It doesn't necessarily change the minds of the people in NCGA who are the current hurdle. And I'm not sure that it brings the likelihood percentage up that much, but it is not harmful.
Certainly not. And he has advocated or he has endorsed his wife to take his position on council in the interim before the next election. Should she get that position and he's in Washington, would that be helpful? Could there be some in internal communications back and forth that might be helpful to the city? And is that under consideration, do you think, Alex?
Possibly. I mean, I think that it would definitely keep a really strong tie to Charlotte and like a strong interest in Charlotte. But it would be a really short term for her. She right. might be asked to not run for re-election, or she may run and she may win, and that could keep that going. But I think that could be a good thing, that if city council decides to accept an application from her and put her in that position, it could be a good move to kind of get on his good side and maybe try to get some federal grants for these transit projects.
Yes, someone has to take his place on council for the duration of his term. His term will end in December because there are elections this fall for city council. And by law, by state law, the person who replaces him must be of the same political party as Mr. Bakari, and that is a Republican. So other than his wife, who he has endorsed, are there other people who have tried to throw their hat into the ring or whose names have come up in conversation on council or behind the scenes?
I think she's a pretty big name. There were over 100 applicants the last time this happened. Wow. When Smudgy Mitchell resigned from the council. So there could be more come up, but I have not heard anything yet about the timeline of this or when they're actually going to open up those applications. So that's kind of the next step here.
So right, when, go ahead.
I just think it's odd to me that they have not mentioned it. Even at Monday's meeting when they discussed his resignation, no one on council has publicly spoken about when do we plan on replacing him or what the timeline looks like. Some folks have spoken already. Malcolm Graham, whom Bakari publicly called a hack a few years ago, I believe it was in one of Alex's articles, has already spoken against Krista, his wife, joining on council sort of as a nepotism move, and doesn't think that would be a good look. But I like Alex, have not heard any other names nor a timeline.
So is there a timetable for them to begin these discussions and pick somebody to serve the rest of his term? Is there a timetable for that?
We have not heard anything from the city.
Okay. When we come back from the break, an update on the Allison Riggs Jefferson Griffin race for the state Supreme Court. A different number of votes is now in play. And we'll take a look at the budget and a settlement that Attorney General Jeff Jackson has reached with at least one landlord. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Zach Turner's with us. He's our climate reporter at WFAE News. Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Some movement this week in the Riggs-Griffin case. Allison Riggs, Jefferson Griffin, running for a seat on the state Supreme Court, is the only remaining unresolved race from the November election in the nation. Initially, the Republican candidate vying for this seat, Jefferson Griffin, wanted 65,000 votes thrown out. He originally contested 600,000 of those votes, reduced the number, and now this court decision that came down has denied that 65,000 vote request, but set up a situation where incumbent Allison Riggs, the Democrat, could have her election victory of 734 votes overturned. Nick, the court is allowing some of those 65,000 ballots to be questioned. What was their decision?
So it's been narrowing down, and we should preface all of this by saying, ultimately, this may very well end up at the U.S. Supreme Court. Sure. Judge Allison, I'm going to skip over for a second your question and give some context. Riggs's camp announced this week they were appealing the state Supreme Court's decision to the federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So we should say with all of this that it's not done yet. That being said, we're getting some finality, some clarity on the votes in issue here. And essentially, after the court weighed in and allowed Griffin's challenge to proceed, we now know that, and then kind of looking in the contours, the State Board of Elections said, well, in light of what the state Supreme Court has ruled, that it would impact 1,400 or so voters in Guilford County, and it would impact a couple hundred voters who are registered to vote in North Carolina but have never lived anywhere in the United States, but through some complicated series of laws were legally able to vote in North Carolina and registered to vote in North Carolina.
To be clear, those voters who have never lived here have voted in previous elections and no one has complained. Is that correct?
All of these people whose votes are being challenged now were legally registered to vote, were allowed to vote here, voted here according to the methods in which the state told them to vote. And now Griffin's camp has come up with some novel legal arguments that has led to this challenge. And that's why it's very likely this will end up at the U.S. Supreme Court.
So the magic number is something around the 1,675 votes, which, as you say, came from overseas voters, from people in the military. And on Monday, Allison Griffin, the incumbent, vowed to fight for those voters.
As soon as that ruling came down on Friday, my legal team was already moving in federal court. This ruling cannot stand, and we will fight it tooth and nail.
And although this impacts only 1,675 people out of the original 65,000 that Griffin wanted tossed, Riggs says that doesn't make this any more acceptable.
Our Constitution demands equal protection and equal treatment under the law. And those who raise their hand and get first in line to serve our country should not now be first in line to have their votes tossed.
It's just so odd to hear a Supreme Court justice speaking like a political candidate at a rally. It's just so odd. And it's even odder for a judge running for Supreme Court to be trying to find some novel way to overturn an election. It just, the whole thing is odd. Is it still the case that these people in question have 30 days to so-called cure their ballots? Is that still the case, Nick?
today, but what Riggs's camp asked the Fourth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals to do is stay that decision. And when we say cure their ballot, Mike, what we mean is have an opportunity to provide a photo ID. And you heard, we should mention this, I think this is a really important part of this. You heard in that clip you just played Justice Riggs talking about military people being impacted by this. And that's because a lot of the group of people impacted are folks living overseas in the military who voted absentee, did not provide a photo ID because you didn't have to. And Riggs has said that, Judge Griffin's camp has said that because they didn't vote with a specific photo ID, which is, I'm not sure how you would do that by absentee overseas, their votes don't count. So he's actually challenging, this is the Republican candidate, challenging the method of voting for military people serving overseas.
Is it likely, Ryan, that all of these 1,675 people in question will have the time or even be aware that, or even know how to so-called cure their ballots in the next 30 days? Is it likely?
It's not likely that they all will, but I'm just very curious about what that process looks like. Whether there's an APB going out on all these bases, North Carolina voters, check this out, or whether it even, who's reaching out or what the outreach looks like. But surely, some of these folks have, most of these people have folks back here in North Carolina who are probably, the ones who are politically active enough and engaged are letting them know. So there will be a certain percentage of folks who get this in, and it just keeps narrowing down from there, I guess, as Nick said. At every step we go through this, we've had people not calling the race this week, but Brian Anderson, independent reporter, made his I've seen enough announcement, which is a informal calling when it comes down to the margin that will be needed through those votes that are left to challenge, even if it were to be overturned. So like Nick said, we still might have a long road with the U.S. Supreme Court, but at least we've been seeing something more actionable than we've seen in these past conversations.
Judge Griffin,
because the ballots we're talking about now are also only in Guilford County. That's where that's just because the State Board of Elections told the court this, the State Supreme Court this week, that is the only county where the Griffin campaign filed their challenge on time.
Judge Griffin, the Republican, has not commented on any of this. The spokesman said that he, quote, cannot comment on any issue that is potentially before the court or may come before the court, as stated in the Code of Judicial Conduct. He is on the State Court of Appeals, which has already heard this. Justice Riggs currently sits on the Supreme Court. It is her seat in question. If that statement is true, how is she able to comment?
Oh, look, Judge, you touched on this earlier. North Carolina judges are placed in a very awkward position for having to be politicians. And before I realized I wanted nothing to do with politics, I ran a state Supreme Court race and in a much less politicized time. But these judges and justices are placed in the unenviable position of having to be politicians and having to be jurists. And what that has done over the last decade plus, probably two decades at this point, more or less since that change was made, is moved the court to be more and more political. I mean, look at Allison Riggs and Anita Earls, the two Democrats on the court, were both kind of liberal progressive voting rights lawyers who were involved in explicitly kind of partisan and partner, political work before they were on the court. Look at, Phil Berger, the Senate Republican leader, most powerful man in North Carolina, his son is on the court. Justice Paul Newby, very political. And so that explains why you have a candidate giving campaign rally speeches, which is not something you are used to hearing from someone who wears a black robe in their day job.
Yeah. Moving on, the state Senate spent some time this week considering a bill that would shift an additional $700 million for Hurricane Helene recovery efforts, and debate revealed some concerns, even among Republican lawmakers, about how North Carolina can continue to depend on the federal government. Republican Senator Ralph Hayes from Mitchell County.
We remain hopeful that the federal government will provide increased and expedited reimbursements. But we must prepare to fend for ourselves. Additionally, this budget also directs various state agencies to prioritize Helene-impacted counties for the consideration of certain grant programs during the biennium.
So let's repeat what he just said. He said, we must prepare to fend for ourselves. How real are those concerns, and where are they coming from, and why? Nick?
They're coming from the fact that, one, all disaster recovery reimbursement is convoluted and complicated and a mess. And I think that's actually part of what the Trump administration has said. We want to streamline this. In the process of streamlining that, just like the rest of government, I think we've seen things get delayed or paused or changed or canceled. And so, you know, streamlining is all well and good when you're not waiting for your house to be rebuilt or your road to be, you know, repaved or your bridge to be put back together to be able to access your home. And so North Carolina is just having to deal with the very real consequences of not getting money, especially when what lawmakers in Raleigh have been very intentional about in their Helene funding is trying to fund either things that aren't going to get federal dollars at all, like private bridge replacement or small business loan and grant funding, or things that are matching dollars for the federal government. But I think what we're hearing now is we can't wait for the federal match. We need to go ahead and appropriate our dollars now.
It's another reason why government is not a business. The General Assembly is considering a budget that allocates only $25.5 million in new Helene recovery funds. So some senators wanted to allocate an additional $700 million just in case the federal government stops the flow of money. More money is likely to be proposed by Governor Stein, and legislators say that they are waiting for his budget proposal, which we've already discussed off the air. Nick will be dead on arrival, so I know what they're waiting for. They also moved some money around in the budget to cover additional recovery costs. Where is that money slated to come from should this budget pass in its current form?
No budget's going to pass in its current form. The governor's budget, which I thought he already proposed, that's not going to pass. The Senate budget isn't going to pass, be ratified. And now it goes to the House, which is going to have its budget, and it's not going to pass. And what's going to happen is the House is going to pass their budget, and then there's going to be a conference committee, and Republicans from the House and Republicans from the Senate are going to meet in back rooms for, a couple months and argue. But, you know, if you recall, when I got here a decade ago, we had the long session, which we're in now again in 2015, and they were still in session in like August and September, which is long even for the long session. And it was not because Republicans were fighting with Democrats, because Pat McCrory was the governor then. It was because Republicans were fighting with Republicans on both sides of the General Assembly over the budget. And so we don't know. We're a long way away from knowing what the final budget is. And that's just the reality.
And the Senate proposed in their budget, at least as of yesterday morning, they proposed a $66 billion budget. They were scheduled to vote on it yesterday. They did vote on it yesterday. And it contains some a new salary schedule for teachers and for state employees. And the CMS board has already said they need to step up to the plate. What they're proposing is not enough. What did they ultimately propose? Do you know?
Not off the top of my head. Let's see. 2.3%, 2.3% pay increase over the biennium, which is over 2 years, plus a $3,000 bonus over 2 years. But look, this continues the long history of the General Assembly under delivering on pay increases for teachers. Although what's interesting is the across the board increase for state employees, which have seen more generous pay raises in previous years compared to teachers. But this year, that's only 1.25% and $3,000 over 2 years. So for non-teachers, state employees, what I think we're seeing is the reality. And I know it's on the minds of lawmakers that they're going to have to continue pumping billions of dollars into Helene recovery. And so that means there's not a lot of extra money to do big raises.
Well, in January, State Attorney General Jeff Jackson sued six landlords across the state, accusing them of illegally working together and using artificial intelligence from a company called RealPage, allowing them to set rents for about a third of the apartments in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, and Charlotte. And this week, the state settled, Alex, settled that suit at least with one of the six companies. Which one?
Portland. If you've ever apartment hunted or live in an apartment, you're probably familiar with the name. They manage over 5,000 apartments across the state, and a lot of those are in Charlotte.
At least eight properties they operate in Charlotte. They agreed to stop using sensitive data from its competitors through RealPage. They were comparing what they're all charging, and they got together and evidently allegedly fixed prices so that they were all within a couple of bucks of each other per month. They did not admit guilt, but agreed to pay the state $100,000 for attorney's fees and for consumer education. Together, these six companies that the state sued control, as you said, about 70,000 apartments throughout the state, and Jackson has now settled with one. Will there be an impact for consumers from that settlement?
Hopefully. I mean, 5,000 apartments is a lot. This is the second largest landlord in North Carolina. I think that it will make a much larger dent with the six other landlords. I'm not really clear on how much this algorithm they were using was actually driving up rent, but the accusations are that this is a lot higher than would happen naturally, just focusing on the market competition.
So that you settle with one of the six, the other five are Graystar, Blackstone's LiveCore, Camden Property and Trust, Cushman and Wakefield, Pinnacle Property Management, and Willowbridge Property. Where do those suits stand, and will there be some sort of reverberation from the settlement that's taken place already with Cortland?
I'm sure it sets, it's going to help those cases some more that they have agreed to this settlement, but those remaining companies have all made motions to dismiss their suits in federal court. So it could be more of a fight with those others.
So two wildfires have burned about 1,300 acres and prompted an evacuation order earlier this week in McDowell County. Zach, what other details do we have? What's the state of those fires this morning?
Yeah, so I was able to get a hold of the Forest Service to talk about the fire in McDowell County. It looks like it's currently at 504 acres, 10% containment. It's facing a lot of the same issues that we became familiar with the Black Cove Complex fires. They're still having difficulty in terms of accessing the perimeter. I think in this case, they're able to use part of the parkway, although they're only able to operate in one lane, using that Blue Ridge Parkway to access parts of the fire and start to burn a fire line around to increase containment. But when I spoke to them this morning, they were saying that they weren't even able to get bulldozers around the perimeter of this fire due to all of the down trees from Helene. And we also have fires further out west right now.
I only have 30 seconds left in this segment, less than that, actually. But the 180 firefighters and three helicopters were involved. Is that normal for these fires, or is that a lot?
I think that sounds pretty usual. I think it is taking a little bit more per acre. It's taking a little bit more because of all of the access issues. You need more people with chainsaws out there hiking down that rugged terrain.
So I want to talk more about the wildfires and some cuts to the EPA that may affect us as well when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Zach Turner's with us. He's our climate reporter at WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City NERB. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Nick Oxner's with us, the chief investigative reporter at WBTV. Before we move on from these wildfires, we've been talking a lot, Zach, in the last couple of months about wildfires in the mountains. These are not uncommon occurrences in North Carolina, but we've been talking, and the media has been covering these a lot more than they used to. Is that because, why is that? Is it because they're happening more frequently? Is it because they're going to be more frequent? Is it because they're impacting a greater area? Why?
It's a good question. I think there's a couple of things at play with the Table Rock Complex fires, Black Oak Complex fires. These were large fires, and it involved the mobilization of firefighters from across the country. So I think it's significant in that way. But also, this is very much a continuation of the story of Helene in Western North Carolina. And we're only beginning to understand the impacts that Helene has had on the landscape of fire in Western North Carolina. Right now, it's starting with these access issues of folks having to try and navigate fallen trees as they're establishing the perimeter of these fires. But as time moves on, that relationship between Helene debris and the way that we fight fires in North Carolina, and the way that we manage our forested areas in the state is going to evolve as those downed trees start to dry out and lead to potentially more severe fires.
So, from dry conditions, we pivot to waterways. Last month, the EPA announced it would likely scale back regulations for the wetlands it covers, and some conservationists are worried about what that would mean for our state. Manly Fuller is the vice president for the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. He told WFDD why he's worried.
Protecting waterways from the headwaters to the estuaries is really important, and the elimination of these tools to help protect those areas is, in our view, bad policy.
Last month's announcement said that the Environmental Protection Agency would likely scale back regulations. Has that happened yet, Zach?
So they've announced the intent. Last month, they were announcing the intent to kind of how do you describe this? They're furthering like to narrow the definition of what is considered a federal water, like waters of the U.S. And this has been an ongoing debate pretty much since the Sackett case a few years back, which was narrowing that definition of what waters of the U.S. are to continuous surface connection. And there's been a lot of debate about what is going to be protected. It's led to a lot of uncertainty. And so on one end, like generally reducing uncertainty is going to be good. It's going to help developers understand where they can and cannot build. But in this case, it sounds like they're going to be narrowing what will be considered waters of the US, which seems like the emphasis here is on helping new businesses, but isn't necessarily taking into account communities that maybe rely on wetlands to preserve water quality or even existing businesses that need these wetlands to protect them from flooding.
At the time of this announcement, the agency said it wanted to hear from farmers and others about how federal interference, their words, impacts their land use. Do we know what they've heard? And is that the impetus behind all of this? The simple desire to get out of people's business, to deregulate everything.
I mean, the EPA did announce a suite of pretty staggering, I guess, deregulations, just rolling back a lot of regulations they had on everything from wetlands to emissions. In terms of what we've actually heard from farmers and businesses, I'm not sure.
Okay. Meanwhile, earlier this month, FEMA announced plans to cancel a suite of grants to help communities combat flooding. And you report, Zach, that some municipalities have already begun investing millions of dollars to start projects with this money. But as of now, none have received a dime. How much money are we talking about that's already been spent, and what, in fact, was promised?
Yeah, so I spoke to the Department of Public Safety, Office of Emergency Management. They said that this represented about $184 million in North Carolina. And like you said, no one has received any money from from FEMA. Even there's one project of this like suite of grants, these building resilience and communities grants. The town of Duck had actually completed their project and submitted their request for reimbursement back in September
Now,
last fall.
in the course of reporting on this, you spoke to Salisbury-Rowan Utilities Director Jason Wilson about one particular project.
It was a chain link fence during a flood event. So we actually had to open gates from the boat to be able to get in here, or in some cases have actually just kind of floated over top of the fence. And this is I think an 8 or 10 foot tall fence.
So clearly he's talking about improving something. What project is he talking about?
Yeah, so I drove over to Salisbury, in Rowan County, about an hour from Charlotte, and we were on the Yadkin River. He was showing me a piece of paper of this like pump station. This was a pump station that regularly floods during severe storm events, and this is caused not, you know, in part due to climate change, but mainly due to human infrastructure. There's this dam that was built, you know, I think about a century ago, by aluminum giant Alcoa, and that has led to slowing river currents and increased sedimentation. So they're seeing more and more sediment build up on the bottom of this river. That's leading to flooding, which risks damaging this pump station. And at times they've had to cut power to it when you have these severe floods. And the picture he showed me was pretty wild. They literally have to boat in. It looked like a quarter to a half mile to get to this pump station to check on it during these flood events. Like you mentioned in that clip, there's this 8 to 10 foot fence surrounding the perimeter of this pump station. They can boat over top of it, just kind of sailing in there to check on it. So the plan for this project was to relocate their pump station upstream, get it to a higher elevation. The project would have cost, I think, over $30 million was the estimate. And that's something that will continue to increase with delays as material costs rise, as labor costs rise. And right now, they've done all the planning. They've got their permits, but they're just kind of sitting on their hands as they wait to figure out if they're going to get any of that money from the federal government.
And this is happening nationwide?
This is happening nationwide. Now, I just know the numbers for North Carolina. This is like an upwards of 50 projects right now that's been impacted. All of this looking at like flood resiliency projects.
I want to note the passing of a significant contributor to the arts in Charlotte, Jean-Pierre Bonfou, who for years ran Charlotte Ballet, passed away on Sunday at the age of 82. He was responsible for breathing life into the North Carolina Dance Theater, helping to move it to Charlotte and making it Charlotte Ballet. He and his wife, Patricia McBride, were the artistic directors, co-artistic directors of that organization for years. And his contributions to that company and to the arts, one of the best companies probably in the country, if not the state, certainly the state, have been remarkable and should be noted widely, because he was a great person, a great human being, on the show several times in the past, many times. He and his wife were on this program many times in the past. And there's a wonderful article about his life and the preparation that he had to come here and do what he did. In the Charlotte Observer this morning, written by Thaden James. It's a wonderful profile of the late Jean-Pierre Bonfou. From, let's see here, let's move on to a group calling itself Cabarrus Citizens for Government Integrity has filed a lawsuit challenging the recent appointment of a new Cabarrus County Commissioner, claiming the process was unlawful. So Nick Oxner, tell us more.
Yeah, so this stems from... Now, former state senator Paul Newton resigning his position to go be the general counsel at UNC Chapel Hill. So, by law, then the governor has to appoint, just like what we talked about with Bakari earlier, the governor has to appoint someone. So he appointed the now former chairman of the Cabarrus County Commissioners, Chris Miesmer. The kerfuffle that we're talking about in this lawsuit started because Miesmer and two other Republican members held a early morning vote. I think it was last week. Time has no meaning to me this week. I believe it was last week to appoint Miesmer's replacement, in which Miesmer was there and took part by voting to abstain, which under their rules counts as a vote for this person. And his presence gave them a quorum to do this early morning meeting. And so this group filed a lawsuit challenging that appointment, saying that, you know, basically, how could someone appoint their own successor if he's still in office to vote? The position isn't vacant. And a judge sided with them and issued a restraining
order. So to be clear, this is a 5-member commission. He abstained. 3 of them met. He abstained. The 2 voted in favor of his replacement. 2 other members were not there, and they knew in advance that one of them would not be there because it was the scheduled time for their regular dialysis appointment. This all is kind of squishy, isn't it?
It's quite a mess, I think is the technical term, Mike. And so yes, they went to court. The judge has issued a restraining order stopping the person that they voted on from taking that seat. I believe they in fact followed that court order. And so the fight continues.
Yeah, the
It
single
is
let.
worth noting, though, that same day as the TRO was issued by the judge, Miesmer was finally sworn into the state Senate.
The suit that was filed alleges that this was done in such a way that Miesmer and his political allies could fill a seat with a person of their choosing, which essentially is what happened. And it warns that the warns the court that LaMarie Austin Stripling, who was the person they chose, that their appointment, quote, constitutes an unjustifiable risk that the county and its citizens and taxpayers should not have to bear. Ms. Austin Stripling's unlawful presence and participation on the board will jeopardize county financing and bonds, as well as all contracts entered into by the county with third parties. That seems dire. On what basis are they making this claim?
I think the claim that they could have picked whoever they wanted is borne out by the fact that they picked whoever they wanted. And
Yeah.
yes, we want government to follow the rules, and there's a way to be political, as all political bodies are, without breaking the rules. And I think here we have a judge siding with the group, at least temporarily, that the rules were in fact not followed. And so, yeah.
Okay. So people ident who identified themselves as trolls hijacked a virtual hearing this week in Mecklenburg County Court. What is a virtual hearing? Remind us, Nick, what is that and
Yeah, so
why?
this is WebEx hearings, or hearings conducted by WebEx, which is how almost all civil cases are heard in Mecklenburg County now. It's a thing that started during COVID and has continued to stick here in Mecklenburg, if not, although not all over the state
So
necessarily.
that. So,
But go ahead.
I was going to say this happened actually last Friday. We're just hearing about it this week. It's how, and here's how one of the virtual attendees to this hearing described the situation to your station, WBTV.
Just out of nowhere, it was like this porn came up on the screen of this man like playing with himself.
And that wasn't all that attendees witnessed.
It was like Islamic hate, black hate. It was a lot of, they had Confederate flags and Nazis going across the screen. It was traumatic.
And she said because she'd waited so long for her spot in line at this hearing, she felt that she had to stay on the WebEx call. She felt trapped.
I've been waiting on this hearing to be set since April of 2024.
Wow.
So I wasn't gonna hop off because if I left and then they came to my name, then I might not be assigned to another calendar call for 2 more months.
So, how did this happen? Has it happened before, and have they been able to track down who did it?
Well, it took about 20 minutes for IT folks to kick these people off. I don't know that we know exactly how it happened. I mean, this is a practice that's colloquially kind of called Zoom bombing, so it's not unheard of. I don't know that we've heard of it happening in a court, proceeding in North Carolina before this. It can happen, and it's unfortunate that it happened, and certainly newsworthy. But yeah.
Well, after the week we've had, why don't we just go fishing? The iconic theme to the Andy Griffith Show, which was set in North Carolina, and there's now a move in the General Assembly to make that show the state's official TV show. Representative Neil Jackson.
It's part of the North Carolina story.
But not everybody feels that way. Here's Representative Amos Quick.
I feel bad voting against Andy Griffith, but I'm going to. The other reason is because there are so many other television shows that I've been made aware of that have been filmed in or have North Carolina as its focus.
He was one of 14 members of the General Assembly in the House who voted against Andy. Alex, does that end this effort?
No, it will go on, but I definitely see there's definitely an argument to be made. There are a lot of shows filmed in North Carolina and Wilmington and One Tree Hill, Dawson's Creek. There's an insane amount of tourism there, but I think that Andy Griffith shows a little bit different because of the sweet southernness and the lessons and just like the feel goodness of it. So
Yeah, lawmakers went to all the trouble of bringing a replica of Andy Griffith's police car and a cardboard black and white cutout of Andy, Barney, and Opie and put it up in front of the General Assembly before this conversation took place. And speaking of characters, the Savannah Bananas are coming, and they quickly became the hottest ticket in town. In about 5 hours this week, they sold out two games at the Bank of America Stadium in June. Now, they've been playing stadiums. They are the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball. They've been playing stadiums. Are they filling Bank of America Stadium, Alex, both times?
Oh, yeah, they are going to fill it. And this is
the whole stadium?
It's 74,000 tickets each night. I don't know the capacity of Bank of America off the top of my head. But I hope it should be, because there's so much demand for this that they're not filling that stadium, then they're losing money, because there was a whole lottery system just to get these tickets, and they sold out in 5 hours.
Wow. They're calling this the Banana Ball. They will be here on June 6th and 7th. Are all the tickets gone?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure you can get resale tickets, but they're not going to be the $65 that they were selling for initially. You're going to be spending a lot of money.
Wow. Okay. Well, if you didn't get a ticket, you can go fishing. That's the name of the Andy Griffith song there. That's called Go Fishing. Zach Turner was with us today. WFAE News climate reporter Nick Oxner from WBTV, Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte, and Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.